WrestleMania weekend, brother. Do a podcast about wrestling and hockey. And
well, no, we should. One of these days we should do a hockey and wrestling connection podcast.
We can. There's plenty there. Yeah.
But no, welcome to the Soderstrom Bubble. I am Scotty Waz. You might remember me from such episodes of MASH as none of them. I don't think I've ever seen a full episode of MASH.
No?
No.
Huh.
Who are you? How'd you get in here? How'd you get into this place?
I'm Jen, otherwise known as NHL History Girl.
Oh, I guess you didn't change the locks. this week, we are going to be talking about the roaring 90s as we start to get into modern. Now, the 90s were interesting. It's the last big push of expansion.
Mm-hmm.
It's how we see modern hockey today, just the groundwork for it. And overall, it's, I guess, the most popular time in the NHL?
Probably.
Suffice to say?
Yeah.
Because there were different programs and different things to get people up in arms. And, yeah, all kinds of fun stuff in the 90s. So much so that we had I literally had to write the things that we were thinking of down for the first time in forever. Because of the fact that we would have forgot them all otherwise.
Yeah.
So... we'll start off, obviously, where it all began. The last time the NHL actually finished in May, and that was the 1990-91 season, as
the Pens won.
Yep, Pens beat the Minnesota North Stars and went
poor
on.
Poor John Casey.
Well, the North Stars weren't they like the first team in forever to get to the Stanley Cup final with a sub-500 record?
Yeah.
Something like that, because they were... They were fourth in the Norris that year. Mm-hmm. They were 12 games under 500, and yet they somehow managed to get to the Cup final. Like that's parity right there, kids.
Yeah.
Second worst record of a playoff team in the Campbell Conference, 68 points, and they just went upset city on everybody. They beat Chicago, the top rated team in the Norris, and in the Western Conference for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
Then they toppled the number two team, and then they toppled the Smythe Division third team, which was the Edmonton Oilers, a year after they had won the Cup.
Yep. That's the last time they won the Cup.
Yeah, and they steamrolled through. I mean, they had five games to Edmonton, and then they go down swinging in six games to the Penguins, which I think that video is about the Stanley Cup run season that we have.
Yeah,
that we should take a look at sooner rather than later. So that's that. 1991 also starting the last, like the early 90s expansion, at least the last time for Gil Stein, who, interesting fellow in himself, being inducting himself to the Hall of Fame. Is he still there? Did they revoke that?
Revoked it.
Okay, good. Yeah. There, little
him and Alan Eagleson.
No, Napoleon complex, Gil Stein. But this was the next season we had expansion into San Jose. And then after that he...
Completing the Barons deal.
Yes, we will talk about that here in a second. And then he mentioned in his last, I guess, ever press conference, because he was only there for a year... the Tampa Bay Lightning and Ottawa Senators starting in the 92-93 season because they were the only expansion sites willing to give up the $50 million expansion fee.
Yes. And Tampa almost didn't make it.
Yeah, Tampa was rough. That was... Man, they've had rough patches, Tampa.
They really have.
But they've been successful in lieu of that.
Well, but their rough patches haven't been quite as rough as, say, the Pens going bankrupt... Being padlocked.
Yeah. No, I get it. But it kind of ish.
Yeah. It's in that same vein.
Yeah. So then we move ahead to the 91-92 season. A lot of changes here. First off, the 75th anniversary of the NHL.
Yes.
Was marked there. It's the last season for John Ziegler, the NHL president.
Yes. Thank God.
And then tenths of second brought into it. A lot of rule changes in the 90s. The first one being tenths of seconds to measure a period, unlike whole seconds in past seasons.
Mm.
So this is where you get your 30.3 and all this other tick,
right.
Tick, 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 tick. Retro uniforms were a thing. We'll talk about the fashion. Don't worry. But the expansion, the big expansion to Columbus. So the first expansion team since 79, San Jose Sharks. And what was this whole thing about the Barons deal? We talked about it a little bit in the WHA kind of segment, but is there anything in detail that we kind of missed on that?
No. This is just the final step in that bargain with the Barons and the North Stars merging as opposed to relocating or folding. And
so, permission to move. They wanted to move to North Stars. The Guns
yes,
did.
They wanted
they
to, move,
to
them.
Move them to San Jose.
Yes.
It was vetoed. Well, Whalers owner Howard Baldwin pushed to bring a team to San Jose. So there was a compromise. Guns would share North Stars with Baldwin's group, and then the Guns received an expansion team in 91-92. So here they are. And then the whole thing with the expansion team and dispersal draft is like, like, I don't get, like, this is an odd situation for everyone, wasn't it?
Yeah. The expansion drafts were, this was a new, an experimental thing, and no one quite knew what they were doing, so.
It was an odd situation.
Yeah.
Because first was the dispersal draft. Mm-hmm. So as it were, the Guns paid $50 million to get the thing in there, and they sold those Stars to a consortium with Howard Baldwin and Norm Green for $31.5 million. And then the team got completely controlled by Green.
Yeah.
And that involved a couple years later to them moving. So the spiritual draft, the North Stars selected 14 skaters and two goaltenders who had played at least 50 games at the end of the 89-90 season. These players would be protected. From the unprotected North Stars player, but excluding 1990 draft picks, the Sharks selected 14 skaters and two goalies. Up to three Shark selection could have been unsigned North Stars draft choices. So if that wasn't confusing enough.
Yeah.
So the Sharks picked 24 people from the North Stars to be on their team before ahead of the expansion draft, including such great names as Shane Chirla, Brian Hayward, who had the great mask of the Sharks with a big shark head on there.
Yep.
Link Getz, Rob Zettler, Archers Urbe.
Yeah, the big name.
He was playing in the big name, but not at the time.
No.
Because he was playing
Nobody
in,
wanted in, him then.
No, he was playing in Riga for Dynamo in the Soviet League when it was still part of the whole big thing. And then the expansion draft happened, and your usual expansion rules kind of thing. Each team gets a player picked from, including Guy Lafleur, who was picked from the Quebec Nordiques.
Yeah, there's a run of those you're going to see, like Mike Richter and Guy Lafleur and
Bengt Gustafsson being picked by the Sharks again.
Yeah.
So that's a fun thing. Kelly Kissio on this list as well. So
he was a popular one with the Sharks.
Oh, of course. I think their first captain as well.
So
there's that. Now we mentioned Archer Zerbe, and Archie was a part, though late, mm-hmm. of this whole big European movement that came over. Like, this was a big time that the push for or European players coming to the NHL was a big thing. It even started in 90 with Jaromir Jagr being, what did you say he was?
He was the first Soviet bloc player to attend the draft with government permission without needing to defect.
So there you go. And this happened also in 89-90 when the Devils got Sergei Fetisov and Alexei Kastanov.
Kastanov, yeah.
Yeah. So that was a big, big thing for him as well, or for them as well. And then, of course, the Soviets started to break up and the states started to break up and all that other
fun
stuff.
Yeah, and the national sport associations desperately needed cash. And so they were willing to trade player rights for cash. Like, yeah, you can draft our players if you give us money. So there were these equitable payments schemes that were being worked out.
Yeah, and I mean, towards the end of the 80s, you also saw a lot of the Finnish players come over, a lot of Swede players start yep. to make their mark into the sport yep. in a big way. And the NHL became finally more progressive towards being a global game rather than the old guard of just, hey, Canadians, North Americans, and maybe a guy from Stockholm who looks like he plays from Red Deer.
Yeah.
A good time for global expansion. Overall, then, you know, of course, we get the Ottawa Senators and Tampa Bay Lightning coming in 92-93. Mm-hmm. But not after a little bit of turmoil in 91-92. The first work stoppage being the player strike, the 10-day player strike in 91-92 over licensing of their likeness rights. And at that time during the market, hockey cards was the biggest thing.
Yes.
The change of the free agency program and also playoff bonuses. This was the last big stand, or the first big stand after Allan Eagleson.
And, you know, the player bonuses for playoff games was a... That's not a first. That was a thing that the Hamilton Tigers...
Way back in the 1900s.
Way back. Struggle.
Early 1900s.
Yeah, 26-ish. Mm. Yeah, anyway, so that's not a new issue in the NHL. That was not a first.
Right, but this is the most prominent because it happened more recently. Players revolt. 24-25. Close.
24-25, yeah.
Close. all right, so then the Gary Bettman era begins.
Yeah, and they changed the title from president to commissioner.
To commissioner, yeah. I guess that's a more... better thing because you can't.
Well, at the time, the NHL was very envious of the NBA's marketing and success, which is why they brought in Bettman, who was a major NBA player.
He was
a figure, I should say.
He was what's his name's right hand man, David Stern's right hand man.
Yeah.
So, and it makes sense. I mean, at the time, the NBA was popular. I mean, they had all the big names and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And a commissioner gives a less unilateral approach than president.
Yes.
Whereas you have to be of a committee, and they tell the commissioner what to do, essentially.
Yeah, he's a little bit more of a figurehead, which I think fans fail to understand.
Yeah, and but he plays his role great.
He does.
And that's why I love Gary Bettman and respect him always.
Yeah.
Because just reading the book and just seeing him in person about his not give a damn attitude to what the fans say and playing into this heeldom, he's a very Vince McMahon character.
Mm-hmm.
So then hockey becomes popular. Hockey becomes a booming thing.
Yes.
I mean, 92-93 had a big thing. Then the expansion into Florida and Anaheim and Tampa Bay and Minnesota moving to Dallas. Yeah. And that was the first big relocation of four? That was first of four?
First of four.
I mean, the Rangers win a cup, for Christ's sake. 92-93, they get the cover of Sports Illustrated.
94, dear.
Hmm? 94. Oh, yeah, 94-95. Yeah. 93-94. Whatever, 93, the point 94. Is this. Shh. You couldn't remember when the Hamilton Tigers
That's
were around.
True.
They got covers of SI. Things are booming. Things are happening. Mm-hmm. Thus, then a lockout happens, killing every momentum.
Yes, and you have a referee strike in there, too.
When was the referee strike? Was that had to be early-ish 90s, right?
Yep. So Referees Association.
This was after the whole, no, that was 88.
Was it? I thought there was one in the 90s.
Nope, so yeah, there was 93, it looks like, sorry.
Yeah, because I was going to say, there was one around 94-ish.
November 93, and they had to use the, walked off on the press that they will be tested. Blah, blah, blah. Placement refs and linemen believe the police engaged one day until officials' contract issues settle. The owners are unwilling to give the officials approximately $1.5 million more a year that would resolve their difference in salaries and benefits. So,
and that was $1.5 million for the entire pool.
Yeah.
Not per
person.
Right.
Don Meehan becomes a big figure because he was representing the referees.
Mm-hmm.
So,
he's really left quite the legacy in the NHL.
Right, for rightly or wrongly, depending on how you look at him.
Yeah.
I mean, super agents and things like that. You know, it is what it is. They're not as asshole-ish as Scott Boras is in MLB. So,
well, I don't know, Alan Walsh.
He's not asshole. Like, he doesn't get the attention for his. Like,
I get
Scott Boras trying to put himself on the same level as talent-wise as his clients.
Okay.
Alan Walsh is representing his clients much like Ari Gold did in Entourage, as being a loudmouth kind of guy and trying to put him over in a big way, but...
I've never seen Entourage.
Neither have I. I just assume as much. Jeremy Piven, everybody. So, strike happened in 94, just as the momentum was gaining up. A lot of this had to do with the expansion of games. Games expanded from 80 games to 84, including neutral site games.
Yes.
So trying to test out new expansion possible markets. So yeah, I mean, they questioned what the games would be, how long the games would be. Of course, the monies were the thing, mm-hmm. because they were pulling in a lot of income, and this would mm-hmm. be for the next two decades.
Right, and but at this point, you have to realize that salaries were still really low.
Super low.
I mean, you didn't get the first million-dollar player until... Was it Patrick Waugh?
I don't know.
But, I mean, you were lucky if you were making... you know, 7,000 or 700,000, like that was ideal.
Yeah, I mean, and that was a big thing, is that, yeah, they were not there. Derek Sanders and Bobby Hull, this is not what I want, guys. This is the NHL, or the hockey.
Yeah, but it wasn't until you see, like, Patrick Waugh really breaking that ceiling, Gretzky breaking that million-dollar mark, like, for a while, $1 million really upset people that players were making $1 million a year.
Yeah. 88-89, Lemieux.
Oh, Lemieux.
1.6.
Okay, I just remember that Waugh was the first goalie to break right. that barrier.
Yeah. So there's that 48-game season after that, and then, you
the
know.
Devils won.
The Devils won the cup, yep. That was first time. Parking lot parade, shout out. Then 95-96, an interesting turn. NHL realizes, hey, we can make money off these rubes.
Yes.
Let's add a third jersey.
Yes.
Let's do this third jersey project. And for a time, it works.
Yes.
It works aside from two, I think works. Of course, we're talking about the Wild Wing jersey, which had Wild Wing break through the ice at the bottom of the Anaheim Ducks.
I love that jersey.
That jersey's kitschy great. And the Burger King jersey, which I like. I see nothing wrong. It's like a soccer kit.
Yeah.
With the swoosh and the big Burger King up top. The other two, the Boston Bruins had the Winnie the Pooh jersey, which people despise, but they wore for years. Mm-hmm. They wore, I think, up until 2002, perhaps. Mm-hmm. The Penguins, Robo Penguin, becomes the away jersey at the time. Like, after... they tried that Pittsburgh down the thing,
yeah.
And then the Robo jersey with the gradients and everything, that becomes the road jersey because it was so popular and so different. The Canucks with their red.
That gradient red?
The gradient red, that yeah. was pretty cool looking. So, I mean, the third jersey was a test, but at the same time, it paid off well in terms of getting dollars into people's pockets.
Yeah.
Like, it made jersey collection a thing.
Mm-hmm. And... you had and the thing with the with some of the teams like San Jose, those jerseys were extremely popular, especially overseas, like Latvia, like Riga, the capital city, actually had a Sharks apparel store in their main square because there were Latvian players. Like, it was so popular. You know, so, I mean, they weren't just tapping the U.S.-Canadian markets. They were tapping some big overseas markets as well.
It helps a lot when you have that nationality on their teams. Like,
yeah.
You could probably see that a lot with Gergensen in Buffalo. I'm sure there's a lot of Sabres gear over there now, too.
Yeah.
And the color, like, you talked about the colors at the time. Like, my goodness.
Teal.
Great. Teal all
Purple.
Over the place. Yeah. Like, it was a wild time for colors, and it was pretty cool, all things
yeah.
considered.
Yeah.
And then relocations, more relocations.
Yeah, I'm glad they never did the, like, the, airbrushed look on jerseys. Can you imagine if they
I don't even know
that?
What you're talking about.
The airbrush with the, it looks sort of like faux graffiti.
Oh, no, they did that for fashion jerseys. They did that for a couple, like, Starter did a couple of those.
Right, but I mean,
yeah,
like,
for the
like
real
the
jerseys. Yeah.
Real jerseys. Can you imagine?
Oh, that'd be bad.
So
more relocations. Quebec City, goodbye Nordiques.
Yes.
You're now the Colorado Avalanche. Winnipeg Jets, goodbye. You're now the Phoenix Coyotes. Yep. Hartford Whalers, goodbye. You're now the Carolina Hurricanes.
Mm-hmm.
All those teams successful except for the Phoenix Coyotes. Successful to a point. I mean, Hurricanes won a cup in 2006.
Yeah.
Avalanche won a cup the first year they were in Colorado.
Oh,
thanks to the
man.
Patrick Wall trade.
Yeah.
I mean, what was the other team that moved? Dallas won a cup in 99. They're very popular in Dallas now.
Yep.
I mean, the two places you can really say they're kind of popular still is Colorado to an extent and Dallas to an extent, or Dallas. Carolina's kind of treading water a little bit.
Yeah, and that's just partly because they really haven't had a whole lot of success over the past 6 to 7 years.
Fair. That's fair.
You know, I mean, and it's hard to want to cheer for a losing team.
Yeah, no, I've done it for years, though, so get over it. Suck it up, Buttercup.
Well, your team's been moderately successful in the regular season.
Yeah, but we supported them when they were garbage, too.
Well, yeah.
Well, Matt Yeats was a goaltender, and Sebastian Charpentier was his backup because Ole Kolzig didn't want to play the last 10 games. And who could blame him? He's facing like 50 shots a night. More rubber than most highways around here, for Christ's sake. Anyway. This is also where the NHL started to market a lot better. I remember back in
TV.
The TV was a big thing. I mean, they got their first big TV deal, and they televised a lot of things. The draft was televised, a lot more television specials. You had like a lot of geared towards young kids and teenagers and stuff like that. And the roller hockey program was a big thing.
Yep, street hockey.
Street hockey was huge because it was going, these teams were expanding into the Sun Belt because you had your Anaheims, your Floridas, your now the teams moving into Phoenix, Arizona.
Carolina.
Carolina was a big deal. And that was towards the end of it because this was around mid-90s. You had the thing, especially with the big California teams with San Jose in there. And like, they had a lot of programs for roller hockey. I mean, I remember seeing in just these NHL Power Play magazine was the magazine I saw it in because they had it at the rinks that I played at the time. And that it was just a lot of roller hockey. Like, a lot. Every NHL city had, like, a little roller hockey tournament or a street hockey tournament you could go to
and
set up. And
it was a big deal because, you know, Gretzky might show up and award the trophy, or Adam Oates would show up and award the trophy.
Bondra or somebody like that. And also it was a very big for exposure of the play. I mean, Gretzky got out there and hosted Saturday Night Live when he got to LA. That's one thing we forgot. Gretzky trade happened in 89.
It happened in 89.
But it had a big impact in that early 90s time where he became a star for all intents and purposes, hosting terrible Saturday Night Live, but he was there. I mean, you had a lot of things there. I mean, the Mighty Ducks movies. The Mighty Ducks movies were huge for kids. And I would gather to say they're still a little bit huge now.
Yeah.
I mean, although you go to thrift stores like we do, we see like a lineup of the big Disney boxes of the D2 all over the place. But whatever. I mean, those were big moves and brought hockey to the limelight. So.
And then you have celebrity games that started in the 90s as well. So you've got guys like Keanu Reeves playing, you've got Cuba Gooding Jr. playing, you've got, he used to be married to Susan Sarandon. Tim Robbins.
Tim Robbins, yeah, well, his son played.
Michael J. Fox. Like, they're all...
Yeah, like, all the Canadian Hollywood people.
Yeah.
They got to it, I mean...
And you have Kevin Smith. You know, putting hockey in his movies, Chasing Amy, she's wearing a Leafs jersey.
Felix Potvin jersey, let's not distinguish. It was a Felix Potvin jersey, so let's...
And in Clerks, they're playing rooftop.
Rooftop hockey,
Rooftop hockey, and they're wearing, like, Devils jerseys, and I think one of them's wearing Pens jersey.
Soviet Pens jersey.
Yeah. And so, you know, you really start seeing it pop up in popular culture. There's a comedian who had his own TV show, and he was wearing a Caps jersey in one episode. Boy Meets World, there's I think Flyer stuff in Boy Meets World, you know, so you're really starting to see hockey pop up everywhere in pop culture. You know, like rap stars are wearing
rap videos were big with Snoop wearing the old Pittsburgh jersey, the Springfield Indians Hartford Whalers affiliation jersey.
OGB, I think, wore Red Wings
No, that was Tupac who wore a Red Rings jersey and he was spitting on reporters.
Oh, I thought, no, there was a video.
Oh, I don't know.
Oh. Anyway, the point is, it was everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, and you've got Nike signing deals, endorsement deals.
Well, we have Nike coming into hockey.
Yeah.
Nike buying Bauer Corporation, who earlier in the decade bought Cooper, and you become Nike Bauer, so you see all the Nike ads with the goaltenders, which could have been the most successful thing.
Those are the best ads
around. And talk about the European invasion, the Russian Five,
yes,
and Detroit, and creating that dynasty, and well, a dynasty in quotes, because like this is a dominant team, but it was always, you know, a huge deal. And I think rivalries, too, in the 90s were a big thing.
I think this is the first time rivalries were truly as intense as they were pre-anti-brawling rules, if that makes sense.
I mean, you got your Caps-Penguins with the Penguins always beating the Caps when Caps were up 3-1.
Yep.
You got your Red Wings Avalanche when the Red Wings are there because Claude Lemieux decides to be dumbass to Chris Draper. Rangers-Devils was a big thing because the Islanders at that point were kind of middling.
Mm-hmm.
So the Devils were becoming the third premier team in the tri-state area. You had a lot of huge... I mean, your Battle of Alberta's was still there, but wasn't as big anymore because both teams were starting to fade a little bit.
Yep.
Chicago was trying to duel with Detroit and then Toronto because Toronto was in the Western Conference for some ungodly reason. And also, I bring up the standings, I bring up the Western Conference, the changing of the names being more geographical, which, rightly or wrongly, I think has succeeded a bit.
Yeah.
I mean, sure, with the uneven league, you're not going to have your perfect thing. But at the same time, why not? Everyone else makes it geographical. Every other sport is geographical.
Yeah, but by the same token, and the NHL doesn't have to be like every other sport.
No, but if they wanted those market dollars in trying to bring it up to the regular people, you do.
Yeah.
Because it becomes like NASCAR then, where it's just like, where now the point system in NASCAR is completely flugged. Like a guy who finishes 13th has the same amount of total points in the race as the guy who finishes 5th.
Mm.
And it makes no sense. So why would you have names of divisions or names of conferences not being geographical? Why, you know, you're already weird enough because you're playing on skates and you're playing a non-traditional sport in a big, big landscape. Why not make it? I don't understand why people want... I understand why they want it because they want divisions to be named after people because they like the way it once was.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I don't think just because you like it how it once was means it's going to be any better.
Right. For some people, it's very much a traditionalist thing, and...
That's bullshit because they don't want the color jerseys to be the home jerseys. That's the traditional way. If you want to be a traditionalist and you want to have these names after somebody, you want the Howell division or Gretzky division or I don't know who, Yuskevich division, like, you can't also say we want white uniforms at home because that's not traditional way in the NHL. It was always color jersey. Shut your damn mouths.
Except.
No, there's no except. This is the hard and fast rule. This is the hard and fast rule of my society. Sorry, what were you going to say?
I have no idea anymore.
You said jerseys except the hard and fast rule is colors at home except.
Oh, except during the 70s and 80s when they flipped it like 3 or 4 times.
And that's just it. It's like
there is no traditional when it comes to some of these things.
There's traditional with how you think you should be.
Yeah.
I understand why people want white at home.
Yeah.
Because it's pretty much everything else, but...
I mean, for all it matters now, to be honest, if everyone didn't have black jerseys, I guess...
No, you're right.
You could have color-on-color jerseys every game.
Well, look at how cool the outdoor games were.
Yeah.
I mean, you have so many outdoor games that are color against color, where, like, the Penguins-Flyers was black against yellow. Red Wings Maple Leafs was red blue.
Yeah. And that's how games used to be played.
Mm-hmm.
You had one uniform color and that was it.
And really this is for the referees, in all honesty, because we have color TVs. We can differentiate things. But when the speed is moving that fast, you kind of have to have some kind of thing breaking it up.
And, you know, make sure your referees aren't colorblind.
That helps. Helps a little bit. But, I mean, like, even with the third jersey, I'm surprised they didn't do it sooner because the third jersey program made it so road teams had to wear white on the road and you had to coordinate what guys were doing. So why wouldn't you have changed it in the 90s? Whatever. But, yeah, traditional style of the NHL jerseys is dark jerseys at home. You will not convince me otherwise. You will not. No, and it's because that's what happened because they had to wear white jerseys for TV.
Yes.
And that was the away jersey. That's how it was brought in as the away jersey. You want to be a traditionalist? The traditional way is colors at home, whites on the road. End of topic. Point blank, period, full stop.
Yeah, that was the original.
There it is! There it is, our proclamation.
Which leads us to a good point.
Okay.
Fashion.
Fashion!
Turn to the left.
Pushing down on me! Pushing down on you!
Now that's
you're
the
an
wrong
asshole.
Song, sir. What? That is the wrong song, sir.
What?
Oh, God.
What are you talking about? Right. This is
when everybody starts imitating the stars on TV. Everyone wants to do their own version of the Gretzky tuck. We have player photos from high school, I think, where they're doing the Bondra sleeve.
Yeah, pulling up, and especially that was a big thing in D.C. is when Bondra pulled his sleeves up to where you can see the bottom part of the forearm protector and his elbow pad.
Yeah.
That was another big thing. Our elbow pads started to have forearm protectors on it. Yeah. That was, like, you can't avoid that nowadays. And that was a huge thing, too. Like, he exposed it and had their own little thing there. So it was interesting.
And Fedorov in the white skates. And
that was Nike bringing that back into a big thing. And, you know, just everyone had the Nike white skates, and that was a big deal. Just the equipment getting bigger.
Yeah.
There were times that you look at stuff on sale, and it's like literally football shoulder pads. Like how, like this. And this
like
is,
how did you move?
It was hard to. So, yeah, it was an interesting time. And yeah, people started to sell a lot more things. Like, Starter was a big deal in terms of having these fashion jerseys.
Yes. And the coats?
The coats. Oh, the starter coats. Jackets. Oh, the starter jackets were a thing. I had a starter jacket. I had a Florida Panthers starter jacket. So
I think I had a Pens one.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So there we go. But yeah, I mean, this is where a lot of the people who nowadays became fans because it got more exposed. Foxed was a big thing. Fox Track was a thing. The puck.
Oh, man, we hated that.
I loved it. I like a lot of things. A lot of things that are kitschy and terrible and awful that people think.
I think at the time I liked it for a short while, and then it felt like, I don't know, it felt like a visual analytic that was constantly being shoved in my face, because you could see from the length of the trail or the color or the whatever that it was being shot this way or that hard or whatever, and it just, I don't know. I just wanted to watch a game.
I like that it tried to get people involved more. I think it was the first kind of social experiment.
Yeah. No, I'm not against it for those.
And I can
of
understand standard definition TV.
Yeah.
Nowadays you couldn't get away with that garbage. So yeah, but now at the same time it's just like, well, I want that back. Like, I want it back just for nostalgia purposes.
They
like
should...
the '90s has become nostalgia now.
Yes, it has.
Because it's 25 years.
We're all of that age now where, you know, the '90s was the good times. It was high school, it was college.
Yeah, it was an interesting time. Yeah. It was a more, everything was turning towards modernization, technology and things like that.
Oh, and the referees moved from nameplates to numbers. And they all had to wear helmets.
Yeah.
Oh, and this is when you see the last helmetless player, too.
Yes. Who was it? Was it McTeer or was it?
Yeah, it's McTavish.
I thought it was Bradshaw for some reason.
No.
Bradshaw was up there, too. So a lot of rule changes. So a ton, like paragraphs. of things. All right, so 91-92, video replays employ for no goal situation. Size of goal crease increased. Crease changed to a semicircular configuration, so you got your half shell with the wings.
Yep.
Clock record 10th a second, like we said. Major and tame misconduct penalties for checking from behind in the boards. Penalties added to crease infringement or unnecessary contact with a goaltender, so goaltenders being much more protected. Goal disallow if puck enters net while a player's attacking team is standing on the goal line or goal crease line.
Toe in the crease.
Toe in the crease rule. Or places a stick in the goal crease. So this became like, and this was all 91-92.
Yeah, this is the early attempts at goalie interference prevention. Plus, they were getting really tired of seeing things like Hextall. I almost said Hextall there. Okay. Hextall. With the stick swinging and the... Like, they didn't want another Billy Smith.
Sure.
Basically.
Which, you know what? Probably should have.
Yeah.
But then you have, like, a guy like Mike Smith now, who's just a psychopath who flops. 92-93. No substitution allowed in event of coincidental minor penalties when both teams are at full strength. Wearing of helmets made optional for forwards and defensemen in 92-93.
I don't think so. I think that...
I'm just looking what I'm writing here.
I'm thinking that's actually for warm-ups.
Warm-ups, yeah.
I think they missed the word warm-ups in there.
Could have been. Minor penalty for attempting to draw a penalty diving.
Yes.
So diving becomes a thing.
Becomes a huge thing.
Because Europeans are in the league.
Well, and also because Gretzky was a...
Gretzky and Lemieux were both big floppers. Let's not call spade a spade. Let's call spade a spade here.
Yeah.
And say what it is. Major and game misconduct penalties for checking from behind. Game misconduct for instigating a fight, so the instigator rule thrown into effect. And then high sticking redefined as anything above waist height. Any use above waist height, so that got changed. Previously it was shoulder height was a high stick, knocking a puck down with a high stick.
Yeah.
So they changed that, and then that got changed to goalpost or the crossbar.
Crossbar, yeah.
As the height. So that was
because they had players who ranged from 5'5" to, you know, six foot six.
Yeah. So yeah, then the next year they high sticking redefined as below the height of the crossbar. 96-97 maximum length of stick increased to 63 inches because everyone is getting taller. I mean, you get your Eric Lindroses in there, your Zdeno Charos start to make the scene.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you get your big hulking guys, and that's where the speed of the game got really faster. In the late '90s and 2000s, you get to see a trap system more, and power forward game get redefined, and then people start calling for bigger rinks because everyone's too big. Olympics become into play too. 97-98, they agreed to go to the Olympics in Nagano, which was a terrible failure for Canada and the U.S. and includes Chris Chelios and friends ripping up a hotel room.
Yeah, that was not a good look.
No, but that's because the game also expanded into Japan. They had the game ones in 97, I think, in the lead up to it.
They did a preseason game, season opener in Japan. The Ducks did their season opener in Japan.
Yep, Ducks against Canucks.
Yeah.
then 98 area. Two referee system for each team in 20 regular season games. So two referees, two linesmen. Also, the goal lines, blue lines, defensive zone, face-off circles, and markings all move 2 feet closer to the center. So 15 feet of room behind the nets. Cut down the neutral zone. So neutral zone was smaller. Goal crease alter, so extend. So it was a weird time for just ice dimensions.
Yeah, well, they were trying to counteract the whole traps system, the whole dead puck, low scoring. Like, they were trying to make the game exciting again. So they thought that if we shrink the neutral zone, there's not as much room in the neutral zone. You can't spend as much time in the neutral zone. Therefore, you're going to have to end up in somebody's defensive zone and somebody's going to score, right?
Mm-hmm. Nope. Then at the end of the decade, the two referee system expanded even more than the crease rule after the Brett Hull incident to the no harm, no foul video review standard. So that's a good goal, whether or not they did that. Overtime goes to 4-on-4.
Yeah.
Towards the end of the thing. And then then one additional point, and loser point comes into play as well.
I hate the loser point.
I'm not. Well, no, actually, no, because I guess after that it's tied, because then if they receive the additional point, so the winner point would be considered
okay.
that.
Yeah.
But I think everyone gets a point in that game as well. But, I mean, it was global. I mean, we mentioned Japan. We mentioned, the Russian teams getting in there. London.
Didn't they go to London for an exhibition game? I want to say the Red Wings did, but don't quote me.
I'll have to look that up, because the only London game that I remember was right after the lockout, because John Bernier played for the Kings.
Maybe that's what I'm thinking of then.
Maybe. But you also have the first outdoor game.
Yes.
You want to go into that a little bit? You were excited when that happened.
The Oilers. No?
It's Kings and Rangers.
Oh, the Kings and Rangers. Sorry, you were in 99, so I was thinking ahead to...
Yeah, no. Yeah, you're right. So, but I'm just saying in the
90s. Okay, so we'll go back. The Kings played... The Frozen Fury? Was that the name of it?
Might have been. Whatever, I'll look it up.
Anyway, it was in Vegas. It was the first game, the first NHL game in Vegas. And it had some wacky features, like the guys driving the Zamboni were wearing togas.
And it was held at Caesar's Palace.
Yeah. It was held in the Caesar's Palace parking lot. For all intents and purposes, it was a parking lot. And
Let's put it this way. It's the first modern outdoor game. I'll talk about the other outdoor games here in a second.
Okay. There's an infestation of crickets, and so they paused the game to try and, like, scrape some of the crickets out of, like, off the ice, like, with the shovels. And some of them were frozen into the ice because it was... Well, it's Vegas, and it wasn't the coldest, and it wasn't the warmest, and so they got stuck to the ice, and they were basically skating over crickets for the game.
Puck drop 85 degrees, going as high as 95.
Yeah.
So.
Plus, they had all those stadium lights mm-hmm. bearing down on the ice, so it didn't help a whole lot.
Also, like, the first time that there was, like, big extra... video production, because Kelly Rudy was wearing the first incarnation of a GoPro helmet.
Yeah.
So that was a thing. They were supposed to have a second game in Charlotte, North Carolina for the exhibition rounds, but due to poor conditions, it's the Charlotte Coliseum. So Charlotte Coliseum, an indoor arena, had worse ice conditions than outdoor Vegas.
Yes.
So, but oddly enough, that was not the first exhibition game outdoors.
No?
I didn't know this either. In 1954, February 2nd, Groundhog's Day, at the Marquette Branch Prison.
Oh, yeah, the Red Wings prisoners game.
Yep, the Red Wings took on the prisoners, and then 2 years after that, April 9th, 1956, the Boston Bruins took on the three teams at Conception Bay Sports Arena in Newfoundland, Labrador, the Bay Roberts, the British Sheertown, and Coley's Point teams.
Hmm.
In an outdoor exhibition. So, there you go. And then the first game outdoors for realsies was in 2003, which we'll get to next week.
Yeah.
But, like, the 90s as a whole. I mean, I'm looking at your... these are, like, European Super Games.
Yeah, there were a bunch of...
Scouts, Caps, and Tokyo.
Oh, the Pens. The Pens buying the CSK...
Oh, the CSKA. Yeah, CSKA Moscow become the Ice Penguins, and then they played in the IHL for a time.
Yeah, because the idea was theoretically, there were so many talented Russian players that they thought, hey, we'll just build our own feeder system. And they bought this team, which was in trouble at the time, and became majority owners, and tried to use it as a feeder system, and it didn't really work, and put them in the IHL, and it still didn't really work. And then they said, well, screw this, you're on your own again.
Here we go. They were a rushing touring team, competed in the 93-94 IHL season, playing one game each against the 13 teams in the IHL. Howard Baldwin, name popping up again as the Penguins owner.
Yeah, he was really an innovator with some of this stuff.
Bought 50% of CSKA Moscow, and signed a management contract to run that club's arena. provide the team with Western sponsorship, much-needed capital, as well as providing Pittsburgh club easier access to Russian players during a time when it was fern to fern. Most notable player, Nikolai Havibulin.
The Bulin wall.
Exactly. In their IHL games, 2-9-2.
Yes.
6 points overall.
Like I said, it didn't work out
it's
well.
Not that good of a team. So there was that thing. Trying to think about here. I mean, I think we might have touched on everything.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of anything else that we
could have
missed.
Yeah, you have a couple of it's the last time, the 90s were the last time a Canadian team won the cup.
Yep, 93
with the Habs. The first Russians to win the cup. 94, Kovalev. There were three of them. Kovalev is the only one that comes to me off the top of my head.
What team? What year?
94. The Rangers.
Rangers. Kovalev. Zubov. Nemchinov, I think.
Okay.
Sergei Nemchinov, I think.
Yeah.
On that list.
You get the first Russians winning the cup. Just some, you know, some fun little firsts. And
a lot of contract disputes, too.
Oh, yes. Yes.
This is like we can.
Well, this is the era where you have actual true agents.
Yeah.
Because Allan Eagleson is now out of the picture as the NHLPA mastermind. So he can no longer control the players. And the players have realized just how badly they've been screwed over for so many years. So they get Bob Goodenow in there. And you see all sorts of player agents really coming into the picture. And really starting to make a difference. And that's why you have all of these contract disputes, because all of these players suddenly know their actual worth to the team and they want it.
Right, rightly or wrongly. I mean, you got Cujo going to the IHL, Hoppy Bulling going to the IHL. I mean, especially with all these teams moving and stuff. Hell, we could do a whole thing on the IHL because that was a fucking wild time, too. So yeah, I mean that was that. I'm trying to think of anything else.
It was still a really fast game, although towards the end you really start to see less of those two-way players and more of the
defined role,
the plug. Like you're a center, you're always going to be a center. You're a defenseman. You're just going to stay back on the blue line. You're not going to make offensive rushes.
Yeah, well. Then you also have like the other guys who start to make, you know, you're I mean, Paul Coffey was still a thing.
Yeah.
Doing his like undefined role situation. So it was
yeah,
a weird time.
It was kind of a hybrid.
And I think you get your bigger superstar. I think there's more influx of superstars or what people consider superstars in this era as well. So
And this is the era of villains too.
I mean, well it also goes what you said earlier about how this was the first time there was big rivalries.
Yeah. And you still have, this is where you see the end of the guys whose job it is to shadow other players on the ice. You like, it's your role to follow Paul Coffey around during the game and stop him. It's your role.
I would say to a point, but I think Esatikinen still had a job because of that. I mean, there's
a
lot of guys.
But by 2000, that role wasn't really there anymore.
You also had the 90s, a lot of weird guys in a lot of weird places. Mark Messier in Vancouver. Wendell Clark on every other team and in every weird jersey possible. You had weird jerseys. I mean,
yes,
fish
stick.
We could do a whole thing on the fashion, which I think we should, in all honesty.
Yeah. And the could have been jerseys.
Oh, the could have been jerseys. Yeah, we're going to have to do a whole podcast.
I have
about
a whole folder of pictures of could have been jerseys.
Then we can post that up on our Tumblr, or not Tumblr, our Twitter.
Yeah.
We should get a Tumblr for this site, too. We should. Yeah. So I think on the surface, I can't think of anything else that I was thinking of. By the way, you were correct. London. Two-time. Had teams go over. 92 was Blackhawks Canadians. Played in London. Each team won a game. And then the next year, Rangers and Leafs went over.
Okay.
So, I don't know where in London they played. Does it say here?
Is that the O2?
Doesn't say where they played. Let me see if I can highlight and Google it. Well, I'm trying to think if the O2 was built then.
Yeah.
It very well could have been, but
I remember when they when the Ducks opened the season in Japan, everyone, the whole plan, the whole reason why they were going to send the Ducks to Japan was Paul Kariya, and he was injured, so he didn't go.
Right. So they had to get Steve Kariya. No one knew the difference. O2 Arena was built in 2007.
Okay, so not the O2. The Palladium, maybe?
Wembley Arena. Played at Wembley. Wow. Interesting. So that
wasn't December. Yeah. Sometimes I will post on Twitter that, you know, today in 1992, the Blackhawks played a neutral site game in, I don't know, Oklahoma City or whatever. And people are like, they did not. Well, yeah, there was this whole neutral site game thing happening.
The neutral site games were interesting. The neutral, just the location of it and just testing out what they were, because yeah, it doesn't give you a good gauge.
No.
Because, yeah, it's going to be like a unicorn. It's going to be like the Globetrotters come to town.
Yeah.
And that was it. So, yeah, very weird time. Wembley Arena. The second time, French's Mustard sponsored the Rangers and Maple Leafs London games. So.
Oh, that's true. This is the era where you get really heavy sponsorship.
Yeah, you get board ads now. Board ads were a thing.
Yep.
Because it's on TV. You had TV deals.
They were to an extent in the 80s, but nowhere near what they were in the 90s.
Yeah. Wembley Arena, by the way, not Wembley Stadium. So, oops. Wembley Arena, 12.5 is the capacity there.
Hmm.
What else have we forgotten? Anything?
I don't think so. It's just, yeah, because this is when you have the real superstars all playing together. And
so, yeah, I think that we can cut this now. We can end this.
Mm-hmm.
That was the 90s. We don't have any questions. We don't care for your questions. You don't give us any questions anyway. To hell with you. But if you ever do have a question, SDR Strong Bubble is where you got to go. Anything else we need to talk about? Should we just go? Because it's WrestleMania weekend. We got ready for the 17-hour We're missing the 17-hour pregame show.
Yeah, we need groceries, so we have to.
We're going to need that afterwards. And then afterwards,
we're going shopping at 11:30 at night.
It's going to take Undertaker at least 3 hours to get to the ring. So, fine. All right, you can find me at Scotty Waz, the show SDR Strong Bubble, Faceoff Hockey Show, The Origins on Wednesday, a podcast up on Thursday. FOHS Radio is the Facebook. And where can they find you at?
NHL History Girl on Twitter.
All right, and that's it. That's where they can find you. That's the only position. Why don't you plug your Tumblr, too, you silly goose?
Yes, I do have a Tumblr. Hockey Time Machine.
So. Hockey-time, hockey-machine. Hockey-time-machine.
Yes.
I said hockey-. so there's that. All right, so for Jen, I'm Scott. Take care of yourself. And someone else has been Cyrus from Bubble in the Face-Off Hockey Show Media Regime. Have a good week. Bye, everybody.